Side 3, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 99. Sparhawk pulled off his boots and peeled off the leather hose. Talon draped the cloak around him, then pulled one corner across the front and fastened it to the opposite shoulder so that it covered Sparhawk's body and reached about halfway to his knees. Platamy squinted at him.
Put on the shoes and rub some dirt on your legs. You look a bit too clean.
Talon went back to the bin and returned with a scuffed leather cap, a long, slender stick, and a length of dirty sackcloth.
Put on the cap and tie the rag across your eyes, Platamy instructed.
Sparhawk did that.
Can you see well enough through the bandage?
I can make things out, but that's about all.
I don't want you to see too well. You're supposed to be blind. Get him a begging bowl, Talon.
Platamy turned back to Sparhawk.
Practice walking around a bit. Swing the stick in front of you, but bump into things from time to time, and don't forget to stumble.
It's an interesting idea, Platamy, but I know exactly where I'm going. Won't that make people suspicious?
Talon will lead you. You'll just be a pair of ordinary beggars.
Sparhawk hitched up his belt and shifted his broadsword around.
You're going to have to leave that here, Platamy told him. You can hide a dagger under the cloak, but a broadsword's a little too obvious.
I suppose you're right. Sparhawk pulled out his sword and handed it to the fat man in the orange doublet. Don't lose it, he said. Then he began to practice the blind man's groping walk, tapping the long, slender stick Talon had given him on the floor as he went.
Not too bad, Platamy said after several minutes. You pick things up fast, Sparhawk. It ought to be good enough to get you by. Talon can teach you how to beg as you go along.
Talon came back from the large wooden storage box. His left leg looked grotesquely twisted, and he limped along with the aid of a crutch. He had removed his gaudy vest, and he was now dressed in rags.
Doesn't that hurt? Sparhawk asked, pointing at the boy's leg with his stick.
Not much. All you have to do is walk on the side of your foot and turn your knee in.
It looks very convincing.
Naturally. I've had a lot of practice.
Are you both ready, then? Platamy asked.
Probably as ready as we'll ever be, Sparhawk replied. I don't think I'll be very good at begging, though.
Talon can teach you the basics. It's not too hard. Good luck, Sparhawk.
Thanks, I might need it. It was the middle of a gray, rainy morning when Sparhawk and his young guide emerged from the cellar and started back down the muddy alleyway. Seth was once again standing watch in a recessed doorway. He did not speak to them as they passed. When they reached the street, Talon took hold of the corner of Sparhawk's cloak and led him along by it. Sparhawk groped his way behind him, his stick tapping the cobblestones. There are several ways to beg, the boy said after they had gone a short distance. Some prefer just to sit and hold out the begging bowl. That doesn't bring in too many coins, though, unless you do it outside a church on a day when the sermon's been about charity. Some people like to shove the bowl into the face of everybody who walks by. You get more coins that way, but sometimes it irritates people, and every so often you'll get punched in the face. You're supposed to be blind, so we'll have to work out something a little different.
Do I have to say anything?
Talon nodded. You've got to get their attention. Charity is usually good enough. You don't have time for long speeches, and people don't like to talk with beggars anyway. If somebody decides to give you something, he wants to get it over with as quickly as possible. Make your voice sound hopeless. Whining isn't all that good, but try to put a little catch in your voice, as if you were just about to cry.
Begging's quite an art, isn't it?
Talon shrugged. It's just selling something, that's all. But you've got to do all the selling with just one or two words, so put your heart in it. Do you have any coppers with you?
Unless you've stolen them already. Why?
When we get to the brothel, you'll need to bait the bowl. Drop in a couple of coppers to make it look as if you've already gotten something.
I don't quite follow what you've got in mind.
You want to wait for this Krager to come out, don't you? If you go in after him, you're likely to run into the bruisers who keep order in the place. He looked Sparhawk up and down. You might be able to deal with them at that. But that sort of thing gets noisy, and the madam would probably send for the watch. It's usually better just to wait outside.
All right. I suppose we'll wait then.
We'll station ourselves outside the door and beg until he shows up. The boy paused. Are you going to kill him? He asked. And if you are, can I watch?
No. I just want to ask him a few questions. Oh. Talon's voice sounded a little disappointed. It was raining harder now, and Sparhawk's cloak had begun to drip down the backs of his bare legs. They reached Lion Street and turned left.
The brothel's just up ahead, Talon said, tugging Sparhawk along by the corner of his dripping cloak.
Then he stopped suddenly. What's the matter? Sparhawk asked him.
Competition, Talon replied. There's a one-legged man leaning against the wall beside the door.
Begging? What else? Now what?
It's no particular problem. I'll just tell him to move on.
Will he do it?
Talon nodded.
He will when I tell him that we've rented the spot from Platamy.
Wait here. I'll be right back.
The boy crutched his way up the rainy street to the red-painted brothel door and spoke briefly with the one-legged beggar stationed there. The man glared at him for a moment, then his leg miraculously unfolded out from under his rough smock and he stalked off, carrying his crutch and muttering to himself. Talon came back down the street and led Sparhawk to the door of the brothel.
Just lean against the wall and hold the bowl out when anybody comes by. Don't hold it right in front of them, though. They're not supposed to be able to see them, so sort of stick it off to one side.
A prosperous-looking merchant came by with his head down and his dark cloak wrapped tightly about him. Sparhawk thrust out his bowl.
Charity, he said in a pleading tone of voice.
The merchant ignored him.
Not too bad, Talon said. Try to put that little catch I mentioned in your voice, though.
Is that why you didn't put anything in the bowl?
No. Merchants never do.
Oh.
Several workmen dressed in leather smocks came along the street. They were talking loudly and were a bit unsteady on their feet.
Charity,
Sparhawk said to them.
Talon sniffled, wiping his nose on his sleeve.
Please, good masters, he said in a choked voice. Can you help my poor blind father and me?
Why not? One of the workmen said good-humoredly. He fished around in one of his pockets, drew out a few coins, and looked at them. Then he selected one small copper and dropped it into Sparhawk's bowl. One of the others sniggered.
He's trying to get enough together to go in and visit the girls, he said.
That's his business, isn't it? The generous one replied as they went on down the street.
First blood, Talon said. Put the copper in your pocket. We don't want the bowl to have too many coins in it.
In the next hour, Sparhawk and his youthful instructor picked up about a dozen more coins. It became challenging after the first few times, and Sparhawk felt a small surge of triumph each time he managed to wheedle a coin out of a passerby. Then an ornate carriage, drawn by a matched pair of black horses, came up the street and stopped in front of the red door. A liveried young footman jumped down from the back, lowered a step from the side of the vehicle, and opened the door. A nobleman dressed all in green velvet stepped out. Sparhawk knew him.
I may be a while, love, the nobleman said, fondly touching the footman's boyish face. Take the carriage up the street and watch for me.
He giggled girlishly.
Someone might recognize it, and I certainly wouldn't want people to think I was frequenting a place like this.
He rolled his eyes and then minced toward the red door.
Charity for the blind, Sparhawk begged, thrusting out his bowl. Out of my way, knave, the nobleman said, fluttering one hand as if shooing away a bothersome fly.
He opened the door and went inside as the carriage moved off.
Peculiar, Sparhawk murmured.
Wasn't he, though? Talon grinned.
Now that's a sight I thought I'd never see. The Baron Harperin going into a brothel.
Noblemen get urges, too, don't they?
Harperin gets urges, all right, but I don't think the girls inside would satisfy them. He might find you interesting, though.
Talon flushed.
Never mind that, he said.
Sparhawk frowned.
Why would Harperin go into the same brothel where Kroger's staying? He mused.
Do they know each other?
I wouldn't think so. Harperin's a member of the council and a close friend of the primate Annius. Kroger's a third-rate toad. If they're meeting in there, I'd give a great deal to hear what they're saying.
Go on in, then.
What?
It's a public place, and blind men need affection, too.
Just don't start any fights.
Talon looked around cautiously.
Once you get inside, ask for Naween. She works for Platamy on the side. Tell her that he sent you. She'll get you to some place where you can eavesdrop.
Does Platamy control the whole city?
Only the underside of it. Annius runs the top half.
Are you going in with me?
Talon shook his head.
Shonda's got a twisted sense of morality. She doesn't allow children inside. Not male ones, anyway.
Shonda?
The madam of this place.
I probably should have guessed.
Kroger's mistress is named Shonda.
Thin woman?
Talon nodded.
With a very sour mouth?
That's her.
Does she know you?
We met once about 12 years ago.
The bandage hides most of your face, and the light inside isn't too good. You should be able to get by if you change your voice a bit. Go on in. I'll stay out here and keep watch. I know every policeman and spy in Simmera by sight.
All right.
Have you got the price for a girl? I can lend you some if you need it. Shonda won't let you see any of her whores unless you pay her first.
I can manage it. Unless you've picked my pocket again.
Would I do that, my lord?
Probably, yes. I might be in there for a while.
Enjoy yourself. Noeen's very frisky,
or so I've been told. Sparhawk ignored that. He opened the red-painted door and went inside. The hallway he entered was dim and filled with the cloyingly sweet scent of cheap perfume. Maintaining his pose as a blind man, Sparhawk swung his stick from side to side, tapping the walls.
Hello?
He called in a squeaky voice.
Is anybody here?
The door at the far end of the hall opened, and a thin woman in a yellow velvet dress emerged. She had limp, dirty blonde hair, a disapproving expression, and eyes as hard as agates.
What do you want? She demanded. You can't beg in here.
I'm not here to beg, Sparhawk replied. I'm here to buy, or at least rent.
Have you got money?
Yes.
Let's see it.
Sparhawk reached inside his ragged cloak and took several coins out of a pocket. He held them out on the palm of his hand. The thin woman's eyes narrowed shrewdly.
Don't even think about it, he told her.
You're not blind,
she accused him.
You noticed.
What's your pleasure, then?
She asked.
A friend told me to ask for Noeen.
Ah, Noeen. She's been very popular lately. I'll send for her, just as soon as you pay.
How much?
10 coppers or a silver half-crown.
Sparhawk gave her a small silver coin, and she went back through the door. She came back a moment later with a buxom brunette girl of about 20.
This is Noeen,
Shonda said.
I hope you enjoy yourselves.
She simpered briefly at Sparhawk, then the smile seemed to drain off her face. She turned and went back into the room at the end of the hall.
You're not really blind, are you? Noeen asked coquettishly.
She was wrapped in a sleazy-looking dressing gown of bright red, and her cheeks were dimpled. No, Sparhawk admitted. Not really.
Good. I've never done a blind man before, so I wouldn't know what to expect. Let's go upstairs, shall we?
She led him to a stairway that climbed into the upper parts of the house.
Anything in particular that you'd like?
She asked, smiling back over her shoulder at him. At the moment, I'd like to listen, he told her.
Listen? To what?
Platamy sent me. Shonda's got a friend staying here, a fellow named Kroger.
Mousy-looking little man with bad eyes?
That's him. A nobleman dressed in green velvet just came in here, and I think that he and Kroger might be talking. I'd like to hear what they're saying. Can you arrange it? He reached up and took the bandage off his eyes.
Then you don't really want to...
She left it hanging, and her generous lower lip took on a slight pout. Not today, little sister, he told her. I've got other things on my mind. She sighed.
I like your looks, friend, she said. We could have had a very nice time.
Some other day, maybe. Can you take me someplace where I can hear what Kroger and his friend are saying? She sighed again.
I suppose so, she said. It's on up the stairs. We can use Feather's room. She's visiting her mother.
Her mother?
Whores have mothers, too, you know. Feather's room is right next to the one where Shonda's friend is staying. If you put your ear to the wall, you should be able to hear what's going on.
Good. Let's go. I don't want to miss anything. The room near the far end of the upper hallway was small, and its furnishings were sparse. A single candle burned on the table. Noeen closed the door. Then she removed the dressing gown and lay down on the bed.
Just for the sake of appearances, she whispered archly, in case someone looks in on us.
Or,
in case you change your mind later. She gave him a suggestive little leer.
Which wall is it?
He asked in a low voice.
That one.
She pointed. He crossed the room and put the side of his head to the wall's grimy surface.
To my Lord Martell,
a familiar voice was saying.
I need something that proves that you're really from Aeneas, and that what you tell me comes from him.
It was Kroger. Sparhawk grinned exultantly and continued to listen. Chapter 7.
The primate said that you might be a little suspicious, Harperin said in his effeminate voice. There's a price on my head here in Simara, Baron,
Kroger told him.
Under those circumstances, a certain amount of caution seems to be in order.
Would you recognize the primate's signature and his seal if you saw them?
I would, Kroger replied.
Good. Here's a note from him that will identify me. Destroy it after you've read it.
I don't think so. Martell might want to see the proof with his own eyes.
Kroger paused.
Why didn't Aeneas just write down his instructions?
Be sensible, Kroger, Harperin said. A message can fall into unfriendly hands.
So can a messenger. Have you ever seen what the Pandions do to people who have information they want?
We would assume that you'd take steps to keep yourself from being questioned. Kroger laughed derisively.
Not a chance, Harperin, he said in a slightly slurred voice. My life isn't all that much, but it's all I've got.
You're a coward.
And you're whatever it is that you are. Let me see that note.
Sparhawk heard paper rustling.
All right, Kroger's mushy-sounding voice said. This is the primate's seal, I'll agree.
Have you been drinking?
Naturally. What else is there to do in Simara? Unless you have other entertainments, like some I could name.
I don't like you very much, Kroger.
I'm not fond of you either, Harperin, but we can both live with that, can't we? Just give me the message and go away. That perfume you're wearing is beginning to turn my stomach.
There was a stiff silence, and then the Baron spoke very precisely as if to a child or a simpleton. This is what the primate Aeneas wants you to say to Martell. Tell him to gather up as many men as he'll need and to dress them all in black armor. They are to carry the banners of the Pandion Knights. Any seamstress can counterfeit them for you, and Martell knows what they look like. They are then to ride with great show to the castle of Count Radon, uncle of King Dragos of Arsham. Do you know the place?
It's on the road between Dara and Serenium, isn't it?
Precisely. Count Radon is a pious man, and he'll admit the church knights without question. Once Martell is inside the walls, his men are to kill the inhabitants. There shouldn't be much resistance, because Radon doesn't maintain a large garrison. He has a wife and a number of unmarried daughters. Aeneas wants them all repeatedly raped.
Kroger laughed. Ardis would do that anyway.
Good. But tell him not to be self-conscious about it. Radon has several churchmen in his castle. We want them to witness it all. After Ardis and the others finish with the women, cut their throats. Radon is to be tortured and then beheaded. Take his head with you when you leave, but leave enough personal jewelry and clothing on the body so that it can be identified. Butcher everybody else in the castle except for the churchmen. After they've witnessed everything, let them go.
Why?
To report the outrage to King Dragos at Larium.
The idea, then, is that Dragos will declare war on the Pandions?
Not quite, no. Although that's possible, too. As soon as the business is finished, dispatch a man on a fast horse to me here in Simara, to tell me that it's been done.
Kroger laughed again. Only an idiot would carry that kind of message. He'd have a dozen knives in him as soon as he finished talking.
You are suspicious, aren't you, Kroger?
Better suspicious than dead. And the people Martell will hire are likely all to feel pretty much the same way. You'd better tell me a little more about this scheme, Harperin.
You don't need to know any more.
Martell will. He won't be a cat's paw for anybody.
Harperin muttered an oath. All right, then,
The Pandions have been interfering with the primate's activities. This atrocity will give him an excuse to confine them in their mother house at Deimos again. Then he will personally carry a report of the affair to Kyrillos, to lay before the church hierocracy and the archprelate himself. They will have no choice but to disband the Pandion order. The leaders, Vanion, Sparhawk, and the others, will be imprisoned in the dungeons beneath the Basilica of Kyrillos. No man has ever come out of those dungeons alive.
Martell will like that idea.
Annius thought that he might. The Styric woman, Sophrania, will be burned as a witch, of course.
We'll be well rid of her.
There was another pause.
There's more, isn't there?
Kroger added. Harperin did not answer.
Don't be coy, Harperin, Kroger told him. If I can see through all this, you can be sure that Martell will, too. Let's have the rest of it.
All right. Harperin's voice was sullen. The Pandions are likely to resist confinement, and they'll certainly try to protect their leaders. At that point, the army will move against them. That will give Annius and the Royal Council an excuse to declare a state of emergency, and to suspend certain laws.
Which laws are those?
The ones having to do with the succession to the throne. Elania will technically be in a state of war, and Elana is obviously in no condition to deal with that. She'll abdicate in favor of her cousin, the Prince Regent Lycaeus.
Arissa's bastard? The sniveler?
Legitimacy can be bestowed by a decree of the council, and I'd really watch what I say about Lycaeus, Kroger. Disrespect for the king is high treason, and it can be made retroactive, you know.
There was an apprehensive silence.
Wait a minute, Kroger said then. I've heard that Alana's unconscious, and sealed in some kind of crystal.
That's no particular problem.
How can she sign the instrument of abdication?
Harperin laughed. There's a monk at the monastery near Lenda. He's been practicing the queen's signature for a month now. He's very good.
Clever. What happens to her after she abdicates?
As soon as Lycaeus is crowned king, we'll give her a splendid funeral.
But she's still alive, isn't she?
So, if need be, we'll entomb her throne and all.
There's only one problem, then, isn't there?
I don't see any problem.
That's because you're not looking, Harperin. The primate is going to have to move very fast. If the Pandions find out about this before he can get to the hierocracy in Kyrillos, they'll take steps to counter his accusations.
We're aware of that. That's why you have to send the message to me as soon as the Count and his people are dead.
The message would never reach you. Any man we send will realize that he'll be killed as soon as he delivers it. And he'll find an excuse to go to Lamarkand or Pelosia instead.
Kroger paused.
Let me see that ring of yours, he said.
My ring? Why?
It's a signet, isn't it?
Yes, with the coat of arms of my family.
All noblemen have rings like that, don't they?
Of course.
Good. Tell Annius to pay close attention to the collection plate in the Cathedral of Simera here. One of these days, a ring will show up among the pennies. The ring will bear the coat of arms of Count Radon's family. He'll understand the message, and the messenger can slip away unharmed.
I don't think Annius will like that.
He doesn't have to like it. All right. How much?
How much what?
Money. What is Annius willing to pay Martell for his assistance? He's getting the crown for Lycaeus and absolute control of Elania for himself. What's it worth to him?
He told me to mention the sum of 10,000 gold crowns.
Kroger laughed.
I think Martell might want to negotiate that point just a bit.
Time is important here, Kroger.
Then Annius probably won't be too stubborn about the price, will he? Why don't you go back to the palace and suggest to him that a bit more generosity might be in order? I could wind up spending the whole winter riding back and forth between Annius and Martell, carrying proposals and counter-proposals.
There's only so much money in the treasury, Kroger.
Simplicity in itself, my dear Baron. Just increase taxes, or have Annius dip into church funds.
Where is Martell now?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Sparhawk swore under his breath and took his ear away from the wall.
Was it interesting?
Nguyen asked. She still lounged on the bed. Very. She stretched voluptuously.
Are you sure that you won't change your mind?
She asked,
now that you've taken care of your business.
Sorry, little sister, Sparhawk declined. I've got a great deal left to do today. Besides, I've already paid Shonda your price. Why work if you don't have to?
Professional ethics, I suppose. Besides, I sort of like you, my big broken-nosed friend.
I'm flattered. He reached into his pocket, took out a gold coin, and gave it to her. She stared at him in amazed gratitude. I'll slip out the front door before Kroger's friend gets ready to leave, he told her. He went to the door.
Come back sometime when your mind's not so occupied, she whispered.
I'll think about it, he promised. He tied the bandage over his eyes again, opened the door, and stepped quietly into the hall. Then he went on down into the dimly lit lower hall and back out to the street. Talon was leaning against the wall beside the door, trying to stay out of the rain.
Did you have fun?
He asked. I found out what I needed to know.
That's not what I meant. Nguyen's supposed to be the best in Simera.
I really wouldn't know about that. I was there on business.
I'm disappointed in you, Sparhawk.
Talon grinned impudently.
But probably not nearly so much as Nguyen was. They say that she's a girl who likes her work.
You've got a nasty mind, Talon.
I know, and you've got no idea how much I enjoy it.
His young face grew serious, and he looked around cautiously.
Sparhawk, he said, is somebody following you?
It's possible, I suppose.
I'm not talking about a church soldier. There was a man at the far end of the street. At least I think it was a man. He was wearing a monk's habit, and the hood covered his face, so I couldn't be sure.
There are a lot of monks in Simera.
Not like this one. It made me cold all over just to look at him.
Sparhawk looked at him sharply. Have you ever had this kind of feeling before, Talon?
Once. Platamy had sent me to the west gate to meet somebody. Some Styrics were coming into the city, and after they passed, I couldn't even keep my mind on what I was supposed to be doing. It was 2 days before I could shake off the feeling.
There was not really any point in telling the boy the truth about the matter. Many people were sensitives, and it seldom went any further. I wouldn't worry about it, Sparhawk advised. We all get these peculiar feelings now and then.
Maybe,
Talon said dubiously. We're finished here, Sparhawk said. Let's go back to Platamy's place. The rainy streets of Simera were a bit more crowded now, filled with nobles wearing brightly colored cloaks and with workmen dressed in plain brown or gray. Sparhawk was obliged to grope his way along, swinging his blind man's stick in front of him to avoid suspicion. It was noon by the time he and Talon descended the steps into the cellar again.
Why didn't you wake me up? Carlton demanded crossly.
He was sitting on the edge of his cot, holding a bowl of thick stew. You needed your rest. Sparhawk untied the bandage from his eyes. Besides, it's raining out there.
Did you see Kroger?
No, but I heard him, which is just as good. Sparhawk went on around the fire pit to where Platamy sat. Can you get me a wagon and a driver? He asked.
If you need one.
Platamy lifted his silver tankard and drank noisily, spilling beer on the front of his spotted orange doublet. I do, Sparhawk said. Carlton and I have to get back to the chapter house. The primate soldiers are probably still looking for us, so I thought that we could hide in the back of a wagon to stay out of sight.
Wagons don't move very fast. Wouldn't a carriage with curtains drawn be faster?
Do you have a carriage?
Several, actually. God's been good to me lately.
I'm delighted to hear it. Sparhawk turned.
Talon, he called.
The boy came over to where he was standing. How much money did you steal from me this morning? Talon's face grew cautious.
Not too much. Why?
Be more specific.
7 coppers and 1 silver piece. You're a friend, so I put the gold coins back in your pocket.
I'm touched.
You want the money back, I suppose.
Keep it, as payment for your services.
You're generous, my lord.
I'm not finished yet. I want you to keep an eye on Kroger for me. I think I'm going to be out of town for a while, and I want to keep track of him. If he leaves Simera, go to the inn on Rose Street. Do you know it?
The one that's run by the Pandions.
How did you find out about that?
Everybody knows about it.
Sparhawk let that pass.
Knock on the gate 3 times, then pause. Then knock 2 more. A porter will open the gate. Be polite to him, because he's a knight. Tell him that the man Sparhawk was interested in has left town. Try to give him the direction Kroger took. Can you remember all that?
Do you want me to recite it back to you?
That won't be necessary. The night porter at the inn will give you 1/2 crown for the information. Talon's eyes brightened. Sparhawk turned back to Platamy. Thank you, my friend, he said. Consider your debt to my father paid.
I've already forgotten it, the fat man grinned.
Platamy's very good at forgetting debts, Talon said. The ones he owes, anyway.
Someday your mouth is going to get you in serious trouble, boy.
Nothing that my feet can't carry me away from.
Go tell Seth to hitch the gray team to the carriage with the blue wheels and to bring it to the alley door.
What's in it for me?
I'll postpone the thrashing I'm just about to give you.
That sounds fair.
The boy grinned and scampered away. That's a very clever young man, Sparhawk said.
He's the best, Platamy agreed. It's my guess that he'll replace me when I retire.
He's the crown prince, then. Platamy laughed uproariously.
The crown prince of thieves. It has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? You know I like you, Sparhawk.
Still laughing, the fat man clapped the big knight on the shoulder.
If there's ever anything else I can do for you, let me know.
I will, Platamy. I'll even give you a special rate. Thanks, Sparhawk said dryly. He picked up his sword from beside Platamy's chair and went back to his cot to change back into his own clothes. How are you feeling? He asked Colton.
I'm fine.
Good. You'd better get ready to leave.
Where are we going?
Back to the chapter house. I found out something that Vanion needs to know. The carriage was not new, but it was soundly constructed and well maintained. The windows were draped with heavy curtains, which effectively hid the passengers from prying eyes. The team which drew the carriage was a pair of matched greys, and they moved out at a brisk trot. Colton leaned back against the leather cushion. Is it my imagination, or does thieving pay better than knighting?
We didn't go into the business for the money, Colton, Sparhawk reminded him.
That's painfully obvious, my friend. Colton stretched out his legs and crossed his arms contentedly.
You know, he said, I could get to like this sort of thing.
Try not to, Sparhawk advised him.
You have to admit that it's a great deal more comfortable than pounding your backside on a hard saddle.
Discomfort's good for the soul. My soul's just fine, Sparhawk. It's my behind that's starting to wear out. The carriage moved rapidly through the streets, and they soon passed through the east gate of the city and pulled up at the drawbridge of the chapter house. Sparhawk and Colton stepped out into the drizzly afternoon, and Seth immediately turned the carriage around and clattered back toward the city. Following the ritual which gained them entrance into the fortified house, Sparhawk and Colton went immediately to the preceptor's study in the south tower. Vanion was seated at the large table in the center of the room with a stack of documents in front of him, and Sophronia sat by the crackling fire with her ever-present teacup in her hand. She was looking into the dancing flames, her eyes a mystery. Vanion looked up and saw the bloodstains on Colton's doublet.
What happened? He asked.
Our disguises didn't work, Colton shrugged. A group of church soldiers waylaid us in an alley. It's not serious. Sophronia rose from her chair and came over to them.
Did you have it tended? She asked.
Sparhawk put a bandage on it.
Why don't you let me look at it? Sometimes Sparhawk's bandages are a little rudimentary. Sit down and open your doublet.
Colton grumbled a bit, but did as he was told. She untied the bandage and looked at the cut in his side with pursed lips.
Did you clean it at all? She asked Sparhawk.
I wiped it down with some wine.
She sighed.
Oh, Sparhawk.
She rose, went to the door, and sent one of the young knights outside for the things she would need.
Sparhawk picked up some information, Colton told the preceptor.
What kind of information? Vanion asked.
I found Kroger, Sparhawk told him, drawing up a chair. He's staying in a brothel near the west gate.
One of Sophronia's eyebrows shot up.
What were you doing in a brothel, Sparhawk?
It's a long story, he replied, flushing slightly. Someday I'll tell you all about it.
Anyway, he continued, the Baron Harperin came to the brothel and...
Harperin? Banyan looked startled. In a brothel? He had less business there than you did.
He was there to meet with Kroger. I managed to get inside and into the room next to the one where they were meeting. He quickly sketched out the details of the involuted scheme of the primate Annius. Vanion's eyes were narrow as Sparhawk finished his report.
Annius is even more ruthless than I'd imagined, he said. I never thought that he'd stoop to mass murder.
We're going to stop them, aren't we? Carlton asked as Sophronia began to cleanse his wound.
Of course we are, Vanion replied absently. He stared up at the ceiling, his eyes lost in thought.
I think I see a way to turn this around.
He looked at Carlton. Are you fit to ride? He asked.
This is hardly more than a scratch, Carlton assured him as Sophronia laid a compress over the cut.
Good. I want you to go to the mother house at Deimos. Take every man you can get your hands on and start out for Count Radon's castle in Arsham. Stay off the main roads.
We don't want Martell to know you're coming. Sparhawk, I want you to lead the knights from here in Cimera.
Join Carlton down there in Arsham someplace.
Sparhawk shook his head.
If we ride out in a body, Annius will know that we're up to something.
If he gets suspicious, he could postpone the whole thing, and then attack the Count's castle some other time when we aren't around.
Vanion frowned.
That's true, isn't it? Maybe you could sneak your men out of Cimera a few at a time.
It would take too long that way, Sophronia told him, winding a clean bandage around Carlton's waist. And sneaking attracts more attention than riding out openly.
She pursed her lips in thought.
Does the Order still own that cloister on the road to Cardos? She asked.
Vanion nodded.
It's in total disrepair, though.
Wouldn't this be an excellent time to restore it?
I don't quite follow you, Sophronia.
We need to find some excuse for most of the Pandions here in Cimera to ride out of town together. If you were to go to the palace and tell the council that you're going to take all your knights and go repair that cloister, Annius would think you're playing right into his hands. Then you could take wagon loads of tools and building materials to make it look genuine and leave town with them. Once you're out of Cimera, you can change direction with no one the wiser.
It sounds workable, Vanion, Sparhawk said.
Will you be coming with us?
No, Vanion replied. I'm going to have to ride to Kyrillos and alert a few friendly members of the church hierocracy to what Annius has planned.
Sparhawk nodded.
Then he remembered something.
I'm not entirely positive about this, he said, but I think there's someone here in Cimera who's been watching me, and I don't think he's an Aline.
He smiled at Sophronia.
I've been trained to recognize the subtle touch of a Styric mind. Anyway, this watcher seems to be able to pick me out no matter what kind of disguise I wear. I'm almost certain that he's the one who set the church soldiers on Carlton and me, and that means that he has ties to Annius.
What does he look like? Sophronia asked him.
I can't really say. He wears a hooded robe and keeps his face hidden.
He can't report to Annius if he's dead, Carlton shrugged. Lay an ambush for him somewhere on the road to Cardos.
Isn't that a little direct? Sophronia asked disapprovingly, tying the bandage firmly in place.
I'm a simple man, Sophronia. Complications confuse me.
I want to work out a few more details, Vanion said. He looked at Sophronia.
Carlton and I will be riding together as far as Deimos. Do you want to return to the mother house?
No, she replied. I'll go with Sparhawk just in case this Styric who's been watching him tries to follow us. I should be able to deal with that without resorting to murder.
All right, then, Vanion said, rising to his feet. Sparhawk, you and Carlton go see to the wagons and the building materials. I'll go to the palace and lie a little bit. As soon as I get back, we'll all leave.
And what would you like to have me do, Vanion? Sophronia asked him.
He smiled.
Why don't you have another cup of tea, Sophronia?
Thank you, Vanion. I believe I will.
Chapter 8. The weather had turned cold, and the sullen afternoon sky was spitting pellets of hard frozen snow. 100 cloaked and black-armored Pandion knights rode at a jingling trot through the heavy forested region near the Arshan border with Sparhawk and Sophronia in the lead. They had been traveling for 5 days. Sparhawk glanced up at the sky and reined in the black horse he was riding. The horse reared, pawing at the air with his front hooves.
Oh, stop that, Sparhawk told him irritably.
He's very enthusiastic, isn't he? Sophronia said.
He's also not very bright. I'll be glad when we catch up with Carlton and I can get Farron back.
Why are we stopping?
It's close to evening, and that grove over there seems to be fairly clear of undergrowth. We may as well set up our night's encampment here. He raised his voice then, calling back over his shoulder. Sir Parasim, he shouted. The young knight with the butter-colored hair rode forward.
Yes, my lord Sparhawk,
he said in his light tenor voice. We'll stop for the night here, Sparhawk told him. As soon as the wagons get here, set up Sophrania's tent for her and see to it that she has everything she needs.
Of course, my lord.
The sky had turned a chill purple by the time Sparhawk had overseen the setting up of their encampment and had posted sentries. He walked past the tents and the flickering cook fires to join Sophrania at the small fire before her tent, which was set slightly apart from the rest of the camp. He smiled when he saw her ever-present tea kettle hanging from a metal tripod which she had set over the flames.
Something amusing, Sparhawk?
She asked.
No,
he said. Not really. He looked back toward the youthful knights moving around their cook fires. They all seem so young, he said almost as if to himself. Hardly more than boys.
That's the nature of things, Sparhawk. The old make the decisions and the young carry them out.
Was I ever that young? She laughed.
Oh, yes, dear Sparhawk, she told him. You couldn't begin to believe how young you and Carlton were when you came to me for your first lessons. I felt as if a pair of babies had been placed in my care.
He made a rueful face. I guess that answers that question, doesn't it? He held out his hands to the warmth of her fire. It's a cold night. I think my blood thinned out while I was in Jirok. I haven't been really warm since I came back to Alania. Did Parasim bring you your supper?
Yes. He's a very nice boy, isn't he?
Sparhawk laughed. He'd probably be offended if he heard you say that.
It's the truth, isn't it?
Of course, but he'd be offended all the same. Young knights are always sensitive.
Have you ever heard him sing?
Once, in chapel.
He has a glorious voice, doesn't he?
Sparhawk nodded. I don't think he really belongs in a militant order. A regular monastery would probably suit his temperament a little better. He looked around, then stepped outside the circle of firelight, dragged a log to the side of the fire, and covered it with his cloak. It's not exactly an easy chair, he apologized, but it's better than sitting on the ground.
Thank you, Sparhawk, she smiled. That was very thoughtful of you.
I do have a few manners, I suppose. He looked at her gravely. This is going to be a hard journey for you, I'm afraid.
I can endure it, my dear.
Perhaps. But don't go out of your way to be unnecessarily brave. If you get tired or cold, don't hesitate to say something to me.
I'll be just fine, Sparhawk. Styrix are a hardy people.
Sophrania, he said then. How long will it be until the 12 knights who were in the throne room with you begin to die?
That's really impossible to say, Sparhawk.
Will you know? Each time it happens, I mean?
Yes. At the moment, I'm the one to whom their swords will be delivered.
Their swords?
The swords were the instruments of the spell, and they symbolize the burden that must be passed on.
Wouldn't it have been wiser to have distributed that responsibility?
I chose not to.
That might have been a mistake.
Perhaps. But it was mine to make.
He began to pace angrily. We should be working on a cure instead of riding halfway across Arsham, he burst out.
This is important too, Sparhawk.
I couldn't bear to lose you and Alana, he said, and Vanion too.
There's still time, dear one.
He sighed. Are you all settled in then? He asked her.
Yes, I have everything I need.
Try to get a good night's sleep. We'll be starting early. Good night, Sophrania.
Sleep well, Sparhawk.
He awoke as daybreak had begun to spread its light through the wood. He strapped on his armor, shivering at the touch of the cold plate. He emerged from the tent he shared with five other knights and looked around the sleeping camp. Sophrania's fire was flickering in front of her tent again, and her white robe gleamed in the steely light of dawn and the glow of her fire. You're up early, he said as he approached her.
So are you. How far is it to the border?
We should cross into Arsham today.
And then,
From somewhere out in the forest they heard a strange flute-like sound. The melody was in a minor key, but it was not sad. Rather, it seemed filled with an ageless joy. Sophrania's eyes grew wide, and she made a peculiar gesture with her right hand. "A shepherd, maybe?" Sparhawk said. "No," she replied. "Not a shepherd." She stood up. "Come with me, Sparhawk," she said, and then she led him away from the fire. The sky was growing lighter as they moved out into the meadow lying just to the south of their encampment, following the flute-like sound. They approached the sentry Sparhawk had stationed there.
"You heard it too, my lord Sparhawk?" the black-armored knight asked.
"Yes."
"Can you see who it is or where it's coming from?"
"I can't make out who it is yet, but it seems to be coming from that tree out in the center of the meadow."
"Do you want me to come along with you?"
"No. Stay here. We'll investigate." Sophrania had already gone on ahead, moving directly toward the tree that seemed to be the source of the strange melody.
"You'd better let me go first," Sparhawk said when he caught up with her.
"There's no danger, Sparhawk."
When they reached the tree, Sparhawk peered up through the shadowy limbs and saw the mysterious musician. It was a little girl of 6 or so. Her long hair was black and glossy, and her large eyes were as deep as night. A headband of plaited grass encircled her brow, holding her hair back. She was sitting on a limb, breathing sound into a simple, many-chambered set of pipes such as a goatherd might play. Although it was quite cold, she wore only a short, belted linen smock that left her arms and legs bare. Her grass-stained, unshod feet were crossed, and she perched on the limb with a sedate sureness.
"What's she doing here?" Sparhawk asked, puzzled. "There aren't any houses or villages around."
"I think she's been waiting for us," Sophrania replied.
"That doesn't make any sense." He looked up at the child. "What's your name, little girl?" he asked.
"Let me question her, Sparhawk," Sophrania said. "She's a Styric child, and they tend to be shy."
She pushed back her hood and spoke to the little girl in a dialect Sparhawk did not understand. The child lowered her rude pipe and smiled. Her lips were like a small pink bow. Sophrania asked her another question in a strange, gentle tone. The little girl shook her head.
"Does she live in some house back in the forest?" Sparhawk asked.
"She has no home nearby," Sophrania said.
"Doesn't she talk?"
"She chooses not to."
Sparhawk looked around.
"Well, we can't leave her here."
He reached up his arms to the child. "Come down, little girl," he said. She smiled at him and slipped off the limb into his hands. Her weight was very slight, and her hair smelled of grass and trees. She confidently put her arms about his neck, and then wrinkled her nose at the smell of his armor. He set her down on her feet, and she immediately went to Sophrania, took the small woman's hands in hers, and kissed them.
Something peculiarly Styric seemed to pass between the woman and the little girl, something that Sparhawk could not understand. Sophrania lifted the child into her arms and held her close.
"What will we do with her, Sparhawk?" she asked in a strangely intent tone. For some reason it seemed very important to her. "We'll have to take her with us, I guess, at least until we find some people to leave her with. Let's go back to camp and see if we can find something for her to wear.
And some breakfast, I think."
"Would you like that flute?" Sparhawk asked the child. The little girl smiled and nodded.
"Why did you call her that?" Sophrania asked him.
"We have to call her something, at least until we find out her real name, if she has one. Let's go back to the fire where it's warm."
He turned and led the way back across the meadow toward the camp. They crossed the border into Arsham near the city of Deiros, once again avoiding contact with the local inhabitants. They paralleled the road leading eastward, staying well back from that heavily traveled highway. The countryside of the kingdom of Arsham was noticeably different from that of Alania. Unlike its northern neighbor, Arsham seemed to be a kingdom of walls. They stretched along the roads or cut across open pastureland, often for no apparent reason. The walls were thick and high, and Sparhawk was frequently obliged to lead his knights on long detours to go around them. Wryly, he remembered the words of a 24th-century patriarch of the church, who, after traveling from Kyrelos to Larium, had referred to Arsham as God's Rock Garden.
The following day they entered a large forest of winter-bare birch trees. As they rode deeper into the chill wood, Sparhawk began to smell smoke, and he soon saw a dark pall lying low among the stark white tree trunks. He halted the column and rode on ahead to investigate. He had gone perhaps a mile when he came to a cluster of rudely built styric houses. They were all on fire, and bodies littered the open area around the houses. Sparhawk began to swear. He wheeled the young black horse and galloped back to where he had left his troops.
"What is it?" Sophronia asked him, looking at his bleak expression. "Where's the smoke coming from?"
"There was a styric village up ahead," he replied darkly. "We both know what the smoke means."
"Ah," she sighed.
"You'd better keep the little girl back here until I can get a burial detail up there."
"No, Sparhawk. This sort of thing is a part of her heritage, too. All Styrics know that it happens. Besides, I might be able to help the survivors, if there are any."
"Have it your own way," he said shortly. A huge rage had descended upon him, and he curtly motioned the column forward. There was some evidence that the hapless Styrics had made an attempt to defend themselves, but that they had been swarmed under by people carrying only the crudest of weapons. Sparhawk put his men to work, some of them digging graves, and others extinguishing the fires. Sophronia came across the littered field, her face deathly pale.
"There are only a few women among the dead," she reported. "I'd guess that the rest fled back into the woods."
"See if you can persuade them to come back," he said. He looked over at Sir Parasim, who was weeping openly as he spaded dirt out of a grave. The young knight was obviously not emotionally suited for this kind of work. "Parasim," Sparhawk ordered. "Go with Sophronia."
"Yes, my lord,"
Parasim sobbed, dropping his spade. The dead were finally all committed to the earth, and Sparhawk briefly murmured an Aleem prayer over the graves. It was probably not appropriate for Styrics, but he didn't really know what else to do. After about an hour, Sophronia and Parasim returned. "Any luck?" Sparhawk asked her.
"We found them," she replied. "But they won't come out of the woods."
"I can't really blame them very much," he said. "We'll see if we can fix up at least a few of these houses for them to keep them out of the weather."
"Don't waste your time, Sparhawk. They won't come back to this place. That's a part of the Styric religion."
"Did they give you some idea of which way the Aleens who did this went?"
"What are you planning, Sparhawk?"
"Chastisement. That's a part of the Aleen religion."
"No, I won't tell you which way they went, if that's what you've got in mind."
"I'm not going to let this pass, Sophronia. You can tell me or not, whichever you choose. I can find their trail by myself if I need to." She looked at him helplessly. Then her eyes became shrewd.
"A bargain, Sparhawk?" she suggested.
"I'll listen."
"I'll tell you where to find them if you promise not to kill anybody."
"All right," he agreed grudgingly, his face still black with anger. "Which way did they go?"
"I'm not done yet," she said. "You'll stay here with me. I know you, and you sometimes go to extremes. Send someone else to do it."
He glared at her, then turned. "Lacus!" he bellowed.
"No," she said. "Not Lacus. He's as bad as you are."
"Who then?"
"Parasim, I think."
"Parasim?"
"He's a gentler person. If we tell him not to kill anybody, he won't make any mistakes."
"All right, then," he said from between clenched teeth. "Parasim," he said to the young knight standing sorrowfully nearby, "take a dozen men and run down the animals who did this. Don't kill anybody, but make them all very, very sorry that they ever came up with the idea."
"Yes, my lord," Parasim said, his eyes suddenly glinting like steel.
Sophronia gave him directions, and he started back to where the other knights were gathered. On his way, he stopped and uprooted a thorn bush. He seized it in one gauntleted fist and swung it very hard at an unoffending birch tree, ripping off a fair-sized chunk of white bark.
"Oh, dear," Sophronia murmured.
"He'll do just fine," Sparhawk laughed mirthlessly. "I have great hopes for that young man, and great faith in his sense of the appropriate." Some distance away, Flute was standing over the scattered graves. She was playing her pipe softly,
and her melody seemed to convey eons of sorrow. The weather continued cold and unpleasant, though no significant amounts of snow fell. After a week of steady travel, they reached a ruined castle some 6 or 8 leagues west of the city of Dara. Carlton and the main body of the Pandion Knights awaited them there.
"I thought you'd got lost," the blonde man said as he reined up in front of Sparhawk. He looked curiously at Flute, who sat in front of Sparhawk's saddle, her bare feet both on one side of the black horse's neck, and with Sparhawk's cloak wrapped around her. "Isn't it a little late for you to be starting a family?" "We found her along the way," Sparhawk replied. He took the little girl and handed her across to Sophronia. "Why didn't you put some shoes on her?" "We did. She keeps losing them.
There's a nunnery on the other side of Dara.
We'll drop her off there." Sparhawk looked at the ruin crouched on the hill above them. "Is there any kind of shelter in there?" "Some. It breaks the wind, at least." "Let's get inside, then. Did Curic bring Farron and my armor?" Carlton nodded. "Good. This horse is a little unruly, and Vanion's old armor has rubbed me raw in more places than I care to count." They rode up into the ruin and found Curic and the young novice, Beirut, waiting for them. "What took you so long?" Curic asked bluntly. "It's a long way, Curic," Sparhawk replied a bit defensively, "and the wagons can only move so fast. You should have left them behind. They were carrying the food and extra equipment." Curic grunted. "Let's get in out of the weather. I've got a fire going in what's left of that watchtower over there." He looked rather peculiarly at Sophronia, who carried Flute in her arms. "Lady," he greeted her respectfully. "Dear Curic," she said warmly, "how are Asladi and the boys?" "They're well, Sophronia," he replied. "Very well indeed."
"I'm so glad to hear it."
"Carlton said you'd be coming along," he said to her. "I have water boiling for your tea." He looked at Flute, who had her face nestled against Sophronia's. "Have you been keeping secrets from us?" She laughed, a rippling cascade of a laugh.
"That's what Styricks do best, Curic."
"Let's get you all inside where it's warm." He turned and led the way across the rubble-strewn courtyard of the ruin, leaving Beirut to care for the horses. "Was it a good idea to bring him along?" Sparhawk asked, jerking his thumb back over his shoulder in the direction of the novice. "He's a little young for an all-out battle." "He'll be all right, Sparhawk," Curic said. "I took him to the practice field at Deimos a few times and gave him some instruction. He handles himself well and he learns fast." "All right, Curic," Sparhawk said. "But when the fighting starts, stay close to him. I don't want him getting hurt." "I never let you get hurt, did I?" Sparhawk grinned at his friend. "No, as I recall, you didn't." They stayed the night in the ruin and rode out early the following morning. Their combined forces numbered just over 500 men, and they rode south under a still threatening sky.
Just beyond Dara stood a nunnery with yellow sandstone walls and a red tile roof.
Sparhawk and Sophronia turned aside from the road and crossed a winter-browned meadow toward the building.
"And what is the child's name?"
the black-robed Mother Superior asked, when they were admitted into her presence in a severely simple room with only a small brazier to warm it. "She doesn't talk, Mother," Sparhawk replied. "She plays those pipes all the time, so we call her Flute."
"That is an unseemly name, my son."
"The child doesn't mind, Mother Superior," Sophronia told her.
"Did you make some effort to find her parents?"
"There was no one in the vicinity when we found her," Sparhawk explained. The Mother Superior looked gravely at Sophronia.
"The child is Styric," she pointed out. "Would it not perhaps be better to put her with a family of her own race and her own faith?" "We have pressing business," Sophronia said, "and Styrics can be very difficult to find when they choose to be. You know, of course, that if she stays with us, we will raise her in the Aline faith."
Sophronia smiled.
"You will try, Mother Superior. I think you will find that she's not amenable to conversion, however. Coming, Sparhawk?"
They rejoined the column and rode south under clearing skies, moving first at a rolling trot and then at a thunderous gallop. They crossed a knoll, and Sparhawk reined Farron in sharply, staring in astonishment at Flute, who sat cross-legged on a large white rock playing her pipes.
"How did you..." he began,
then broke off.
Sifrania, he called, but the white-robed woman had already dismounted. She approached the child, speaking gently to her in that strange, styric dialect. Flute lowered her pipes and gave Sparhawk an impish little grin. Sifrania laughed and took the child in her arms.
How did she get ahead of us? Colton asked, his face baffled.
Who knows? Sparhawk replied. I guess I'd better take her back.
No, Sparhawk, Sifrania said firmly. She wants to go with us.
That's too bad, he said bluntly. I'm not going to take a little girl into battle.
Don't concern yourself with her, Sparhawk. I'll care for her.
She smiled at the child nestled in her arms.
I'll care for her as if she were my own.
She laid her cheek against Flute's glossy black hair.
In a way, she is.
He gave up. Have it your own way, he said. Just as he began to wheel Farron around, he felt a sudden chill accompanied by the sense of an implacable hatred. Sifrania, he said sharply.
I felt it too, she cried, drawing the little girl closer to her. It's directed at the child.
Flute struggled briefly, and Sifrania, looking surprised, set her down. The little girl's face was set, looking more annoyed than angered or frightened. She set her pipes to her lips and began to play. The melody this time was not that light air in a minor key which she had played before. It was sterner and peculiarly ominous. Then, from some distance away, they heard a sudden howl of pain and surprise. The howl immediately began to fade, as if whoever or whatever had made it were fleeing at an unimaginable rate.
What was that? Colton exclaimed.
An unfriendly spirit, Sifrania replied calmly.
What drove it away?
The child's song. It seems that she has learned to protect herself.
Do you understand any of what's going on here? Colton asked Sparhawk.
No more than you do. Let's keep moving. We've still got a couple of days' hard riding ahead of us. The castle of Count Radon, the uncle of King Dragos, was perched atop a high, rocky promontory. Like so many of the castles in the southern kingdom, it was surrounded by massive walls. The weather had cleared off, and the noonday sun was very bright as Sparhawk, Colton, and Sifrania, who still carried Flute in front of her saddle, rode across a broad meadow of yellow grass toward the fortress. They were admitted without question. In the courtyard, they were met by the Count, a blocky man with heavy shoulders and silver-shot hair. He wore a dark green doublet trimmed in black and surmounted by a heavily starched white ruff of a collar. It was a style which had gone out of fashion in Alania decades ago.
My house is honored to welcome the Knights of the Church, he declared formally after they had introduced themselves.
Sparhawk swung down off Farron's back. Your hospitality is legendary, my lord, he said, but our visit is not entirely social. Is there some place private where we can talk? We have a matter of some urgency to discuss with you.
Of course, the Count replied. If you will all be so good as to come with me.
They followed him through the broad doors of his castle and along a candle-lit corridor strewn with rushes. At the end of the corridor, the Count produced a brass key and unlocked a door.
My private study, he said modestly. I'm rather proud of my collection of books. I have almost 24.
Formidable, Sifrania murmured.
Perhaps you might care to read some of them, madam.
The lady doesn't read, Sparhawk told him. She's a spirit, and an initiate in the secrets. She feels that reading might somehow interfere with her abilities.
A witch, the Count said, looking at the small woman. Truly?
We prefer to use other terms, my lord, she replied mildly.
Please, sit down,
the Count said, pointing at a large table standing in a chill patch of wintry sunlight coming through a heavily barred window.
I'm curious to hear about this urgent matter.
Sparhawk removed his helmet and gauntlets and laid them on the table.
Are you familiar with the name of Annius, Primate of Cimera, my lord?
The Count's face hardened.
I've heard of him, he said shortly.
You know his reputation, then?
I do.
Good. Quite by accident, Sir Colton and I unearthed a plot hatched by the Primate. Fortunately, he isn't aware of the fact that we know about it. Is it your common practice so freely to admit church knights?
Of course. I revere the church and honor her knights.
Within a few days, a week at most, a sizable group of men in black armor and bearing the standards of Pandion knights will ride up to your gates. I strongly advise you not to admit them.
Sparhawk held up one hand. They will not be Pandions, my lord. They're mercenaries under the command of a renegade named Martell. If you let them in, they will kill everyone within your walls, excepting only a churchman or two who will spread word of the outrage.
Monstrous, the Count gasped. What reason could the Primate of Simera have to bear me such hatred?
The plot isn't directed at you, Count Radin, Colton told him. Your murder is designed to discredit the Pandion Knights. Annius hopes that the hierocracy of the Church will be so infuriated that they'll disband the Order.
I must send word to Larium at once, the Count declared, coming to his feet. My nephew can have an army here in a few days.
That won't be necessary, my lord, Sparhawk said. I have 500 fully armed Pandions, real ones, concealed in the woods just to the north of your castle. With your permission, I'll bring 100 of them inside your walls to reinforce your garrison. When the mercenaries arrive, find some excuse not to admit them.
Won't that seem strange? Radin asked. I have a reputation for hospitality, for the Knights of the Church in particular.
The drawbridge, Colton said.
I beg your pardon?
Tell them that the windlass that operates your drawbridge is broken. Then tell them that you have men working on it, and ask them to be patient.
I will not lie, the Count said stiffly.
That's all right, my lord, Colton assured him. I'll break the windlass for you myself, so you won't really be lying. The Count stared at him for a moment, then burst out laughing. The mercenaries will be outside the castle, Sparhawk went on, and your walls will give them very little room for maneuvering. That's when we'll attack them from behind. Colton grinned broadly.
It should be almost like a cheese grater when we start to grind them up against your walls.
And I can drop some interesting things on them from my battlements as well, the Count added, also grinning.
Arrows, large rocks, burning pitch, that sort of thing.
We're going to get on splendidly, my lord, Colton told him.
I will, of course, make arrangements to lodge this lady and the little girl here in safety, the Count said.
No, my lord, Sophronia disagreed. I will accompany Sir Sparhawk and Sir Colton back to our hiding place. This Martell Sparhawk mentioned is a former Pandion, and he has delved deeply into secret knowledge that is forbidden to honest men. It may be necessary to counter him, and I'm best equipped to do that.
But surely the child...
The child must stay with me, Sophronia said firmly. She looked over at Flute, who was in the act of curiously opening a book.
No,
she said, probably more sharply than she had intended. She rose and took the book away from the little girl. Flute sighed, and Sophronia spoke briefly to her in that dialect Sparhawk did not understand. Since there was no way to know when Martell's mercenaries might arrive, the Pandions built no fires that night, and when the next morning dawned clear and cold, Sparhawk unrolled himself from his blankets and looked with some distaste at his armor, knowing that it would take at least an hour for the heat of his body to take the clammy chill out of it. He decided that he was not ready to face that just yet, so he belted on his sword, pulled his stout cloak around his shoulders, and walked down through the sleeping camp toward a small brook that trickled through the woods where he and his knights lay hidden. He knelt beside the brook and drank from his cupped hands, then braced himself and splashed icy water on his face. Then he rose, dried his face with the hem of his cloak, and stepped across the brook. The just-risen sun streamed golden into the leafless wood, slanting between the dark trunks and touching fire into the dewdrops collected like strings of beads along the stems of the grass about his feet. Sparhawk walked on through the woods. He had gone perhaps half a mile when he saw a grassy meadow through the trees. As he approached the meadow, he heard the thudding of hooves. Somewhere ahead, a single horse was loping across the turf at a canter. And then he heard the sound of flute's pipes rising in the morning air. He pushed his way to the edge of the meadow, parted the bushes, and peered out. Farron, his roan coat glistening in the morning sun, cantered easily in a wide circular course around the meadow. He wore no saddle nor bridle, and there was something almost joyful about his stride. Flute lay face up on his back with her pipes at her lips. Her head was nestled comfortably on his surging front shoulders. Her knees were crossed, and she was beating time on Farron's rump with one little foot. Sparhawk gaped at them, then stepped out into the meadow to stand directly in the big roan's path. He spread his arms wide, and Farron slowed to a walk, and then stopped in front of his master. "What do you think you're doing?" Sparhawk barked at him. Farron's expression grew lofty, and he looked away.
"Have you completely taken leave of your senses?"
Farron snorted and flicked his tail, even as Flute continued to play her song. Then the little girl slapped her grass-stained foot imperiously on his rump several times, and he neatly sidestepped the fuming Sparhawk and cantered on, with Flute's song soaring above him. Sparhawk swore and ran after them. After a few yards, he knew it was hopeless, and he stopped, breathing hard.
"Interesting, wouldn't you say?" Sophronia said. She had come out from among the trees and stood at the edge of the meadow with her white robe gleaming in the morning sun.
"Can you make them stop?" Sparhawk asked her. "She's going to fall off and get hurt."
"No, Sparhawk," Sophronia disagreed. "She will not fall."
She said it in that strange manner into which she sometimes lapsed. Despite the decades she had spent in Aline society, Sophronia remained a Styrix to her fingertips. And Styrix had always been an enigma to Alines. The centuries of close association between the militant orders of the Aline Church and their Styrix tutors, however, had taught the church knights to accept the words of their instructors without question.
"If you're sure," Sparhawk said a bit dubiously as he looked across the turf at Farron, who seemed somehow to have lost his normally vicious temperament.
"Yes, dear one," she said, laying an affectionate hand on his arm in reassurance. "I'm absolutely sure."
She looked out at the great horse and his tiny passenger, joyously circling the dew-drenched meadow in the golden morning sunlight.
"Let them play a while longer," she advised.
About mid-morning, Calton returned from the vantage point to the south of the castle, where he and Curic had been keeping watch over the road coming up from Serenium.
"Nothing yet," he reported as he dismounted, his armor clinking.
"Do you think Martell might just try to come across country and avoid the roads?"
"It's not very likely," Sparhawk replied. "He wants to be seen, remember? He needs lots of witnesses."
"I suppose I hadn't thought of that," Calton admitted. "Have you got the road coming down from Dara covered?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"Lacus and Bayret are watching it."
"Bayret?"
Calton sounded surprised.
"The apprentice?
Isn't he a little young?"
"He'll get over it. He's steady and he's got good sense. Besides, Lacus can keep him out of trouble."
"You're probably right. Is there any of that roast ox the Count sent us left?"
"Help yourself. It isn't hot, though."
Calton shrugged.
"Better cold meat than no meat."
The day dragged on, as days spent only in waiting will do. By evening, Sparhawk was pacing the camp with his impatience gnawing at him. Finally, Sophronia emerged from the rough little tent she shared with Flute. She placed herself directly in front of the big knight in black armor with her hands on her hips.
"Will you stop that?" she demanded crossly.
"Stop what?"
"Pacing. You jingle at every step, and the noise is very distracting."
"I'm sorry. I'll go jingle on the other side of camp."
"Why not just go sit down?"
"Nerves, I guess."
"Nerves? You?"
"I get twinges now and then."
"Well, go twinge someplace else."
"Yes, little mother," he replied obediently.
It was cold again the following morning. Curic rode quietly into camp just before sunrise. He carefully picked his way past the sleeping knights wrapped in their black cloaks to the place where Sparhawk had spread his blankets.
"You'd better get up," he said, lightly touching Sparhawk's shoulder. "They're coming."
Sparhawk sat up quickly.
"How many?" he asked, throwing off his blankets.
"I make it about 250. Sparhawk stood up.
"Where's Calton?" he asked as Curic began to buckle the black armor over his lord's padded tunic.
"He wanted to make sure that there wouldn't be any surprises, so he joined the end of their column."
"He did what?"
"Don't worry, Sparhawk. They're all wearing black armor, so he blends right in."
"Do you want to tie this on?"
Sparhawk handed his squire the length of bright ribbon that each knight was to wear as a means of identification during a battle in which both sides would be dressed in black. Curic took the red ribbon.
"Calton's wearing a blue one," he noted. "It matches his eyes."
He tied the ribbon around Sparhawk's upper arm, then stepped back and looked at his lord appraisingly.
"Adorable," he said, rolling his eyes.
Sparhawk laughed and clapped his friend on the shoulder.
"Let's go wake the children," he said, looking across the encampment of generally youthful knights.
"I've got some bad news for you, Sparhawk,"
Shurik said as the two of them moved out through the camp, shaking the sleeping Pandions awake.
What's that?
The man leading the column isn't Martell. Sparhawk felt a hot surge of disappointment.
Who is it? He asked.
Addis. He had blood all over his chin. I think he's been eating raw meat again. Sparhawk swore. Look at it this way. At least the world's going to be a cleaner place without Addis. And I'd imagine that God would like to have a long talk with him anyway.
We'll have to see what we can do to arrange that.
Sparhawk's knights were assisting each other into their armor when Calton rode into camp.
They've pulled up just beyond that hill to the south of the castle, he reported, not bothering to dismount.
Is Martell possibly lurking around somewhere among them? Sparhawk asked, hopefully.
Calton shook his head.
I'm afraid not. He stood up in his stirrups, shifting his sword around.
Why don't we just go ahead and attack them? He suggested. I'm getting cold.
I think Count Radin would be disappointed if we didn't let him take part in the fight.
That's true, I suppose.
Is there anything unusual about the mercenaries?
Run of the mill, except that about half of them are Rendors.
Rendors?
They don't smell very good, do they?
Sifrania, accompanied by Parasim and Flute, came up to join them.
Good morning, Sifrania, Sparhawk greeted her.
Why all the bustle? She asked.
We have company coming. We thought we'd ride out to greet them.
Martell?
No. I'm afraid it's only Addis. And a few friends.
He shifted the helmet he was holding under his left arm.
Since Martell isn't leading them, and since Addis can barely speak Alaenic, much less Styric, there isn't anybody out there who could stir up enough magic to knock a fly off the wall. I'm afraid that means that you've made the trip for nothing. I want you to stay back here in the woods, well hidden and out of danger. Sir Parasim will stay with you.
The young knight's face filled with disappointment.
No, Sparhawk, Sifrania replied. I need no guard, and this is Parasim's first battle. We won't deprive him of it.
Parasim's face shone with gratitude.
Curic came back through the woods from the place where he had been keeping watch. The sun's coming up, he reported, and Addis is leading his men over the top of that hill.
We'd better mount up then, Sparhawk said. The Pandions swung up into their saddles and moved cautiously through the wood until they reached the edge of the broad meadow that surrounded the Count's castle. Then they waited, watching the black-armored mercenaries riding down the hill in the golden dawn sunlight. Addis, who normally spoke in grunts and belches, rode up to the gate of Count Radin's castle and read haltingly from a piece of paper which he held in front of him at arm's length.
Can't he extemporize? Calton asked quietly. He's only asking for permission to enter the castle.
Martell doesn't take chances, Sparhawk replied. And Addis usually has trouble remembering his own name.
Addis continued to read his request. He had some trouble with the word admission, since it had more than one syllable.
Then Count Radin appeared on the battlements to announce regretfully that the windlass which raised and lowered the drawbridge was broken, and to beg them to be patient until it was repaired.
Addis mulled that over. It took him quite a while. The mercenaries dismounted and lounged about on the grass at the foot of the castle wall.
This is going to be almost too easy, Calton muttered.
Let's just make sure that none of them get away, Sparhawk told him. I don't want anybody riding to Anius with word of what really happens today.
I still think Vanion's trying to be too clever about this.
Maybe that's why he's the preceptor and we're only knights.
A red banner appeared atop the Count's walls.
There's the signal, Sparhawk said. Redden's forces are ready.
He put on his helmet, gathered his reins and rose in his stirrups, firmly holding Farron in. Then he raised his voice.
Charge! He roared.
Chapter 9.
Any chance at all? Calton asked.
No, Sparhawk replied with deep regret as he lowered Sir Parasim to the ground. He's gone. He smoothed the young knight's hair with his hand, then gently closed the vacant eyes.
He wasn't ready to come up against Addis, Calton said.
Did that animal get completely away?
I'm afraid so. After he cut down Parasim, he rode off to the south with about a dozen other survivors.
Send some people after him, Sparhawk said bleakly as he straightened the fallen Sir Parasim's limbs.
Tell them to run him into the sea if necessary.
Do you want me to do it?
No. You and I have to go to Kyrillos. He raised his voice then.
Beirut!
He shouted. The novice approached at a half run. He was wearing an old mail shirt splashed with blood and a dented foot soldier's helmet with no visor. He carried a grim, long-handled battle axe. Sparhawk looked closely at the blood on the rangy youth's mail shirt.
Is any of that yours? He asked.
No, my lord, Beirut answered. All theirs. He looked pointedly at the mercenary dead littering the field.
Good. What's your feeling about a long ride?
As my lord commands.
He's got good manners, at least, Carlton observed.
Beirut, he said then, ask where before you agree so quickly.
I'll remember that, my lord Carlton.
I want you to come with me, Sparhawk said to the novice. We need to talk with Count Radin before you leave. He turned to Carlton.
Get a group of men to chase Addis, he said. Push him hard. I don't want him to have time to send one of his people to Simera to report all of this to Ennius. Tell the rest of the men to bury our dead and care for the wounded.
What about these? Carlton pointed at the dead bodies of the mercenaries heaped in front of the castle walls.
Burn them.
Count Radin met Sparhawk and Beirut in the courtyard of his castle. He was wearing full armor and held his sword in his hand.
I see that the reputation of the Pandions is well deserved, he said.
Thank you, my lord, Sparhawk replied.
I have a favor, no, two favors, to ask of you.
Anything, Sir Sparhawk.
Are you known to any members of the hierocracy in Kyrillos?
Several, actually. And the Patriarch of Larium is a distant cousin of mine.
Very good. I know it's a bad season for travel, but I'd like for you to join me in a little ride.
Of course. Where are we going?
To Kyrillos.
The next favor is a bit more personal.
I'll need your signet ring.
My ring?
The Count lifted his hand and looked at the heavy gold ring bearing his coat of arms.
Sparhawk nodded.
And worse yet, I can't guarantee that I'll be able to return it.
I'm not sure that I understand.
Beirut here is going to take the ring to Simera and drop it in the collection plate during services in the cathedral there. The primate Ennius will take that to mean that his scheme has succeeded and that you and your family have all been murdered. He will then rush to Kyrillos to lay charges against the Pandions before the hierocracy.
Count Radin grinned broadly.
But then you and I will step forward and refute those charges, right?
Sparhawk grinned back.
Exactly, he said.
That might cause the primate a certain amount of embarrassment, the Count said as he tugged the ring off his finger.
That was sort of what we had in mind, my lord.
The ring is well lost, then, Radin said, handing his signet to Beirut.
All right, Sparhawk said to the young novice. Don't kill any horses on your way to Simera. Give us time to get to Kyrillos before Ennius does.
He squinted thoughtfully.
Morning service, I think.
My lord,
drop the Count's ring in the collection plate during morning services.
Let's give Ennius a whole day to gloat before he starts out for Kyrillos. Wear ordinary clothes when you go into the cathedral and pray a bit, just to make it look convincing. Don't go near the chapter house or the inn on Rose Street.
He looked at the young novice, feeling a renewed pang at the loss of Sir Parasim.
I can't assure you that your life won't be in danger, Beirut, he said soberly, so I can't order you to do this.
There's no need to order me to do it, my lord Sparhawk, Beirut replied.
Good man, Sparhawk said.
Now go get your horse. You've got a long ride ahead of you.
It was nearly noon when Sparhawk and Count Radin emerged from the castle.
How long do you think it's going to take for Primate Ennius to reach Kyrillos? The Count asked.
2 weeks at least. Beirut has to get to Simera before Ennius can even start for Kyrillos.
Curic came riding up to them.
Everything's ready, he told Sparhawk.
Sparhawk nodded.
You'd better go get Sophronia, he said.
Is that really a good idea, Sparhawk? Things might get a little chancy when we get to Kyrillos.
Do you want to be the one to tell her that she has to stay behind?
Curic winced.
I see what you mean, he said.
Where's Carlton?
Over there at the edge of the woods. He's building a bonfire for some reason.
Maybe he's cold.
The winter sun was very bright in the cold blue sky as Sparhawk and his party set out.
"Surely, madam," Count Radin objected to Sophronia, "the child would have been quite safe within the walls of my castle."
"She would not have stayed there, my lord," Sophronia replied in a small voice. She laid her cheek against Flute's hair.
"Besides," she added, "I take great comfort in having her with me."
Her voice sounded weak somehow, and she looked very pale and tired. In one hand she carried Sir Parison's sword.
Sparhawk pulled Farron in beside her white palfrey.
"Are you all right?" he asked her quietly.
"Not really," she answered.
"What's the matter?" He felt a sudden alarm.
"Parison was one of the 12 knights in the throne room in Simera." She sighed. "I've just been obliged to shoulder his burden as well as my own."
She gestured slightly with the sword. "You're not ill, are you?"
"Not in the way that you mean, no. It's just that it's going to take a little while to adjust to the additional weight."
"Is there any way that I could carry it for you?"
"No, dear one."
He drew in a deep breath. "Sophronia," he said, "is what happened to Parison today a part of what you told me was going to happen to the 12 knights?"
"There's no way to know, Sparhawk. The compact we made with the younger gods was not that specific."
She smiled wanly.
"If another of the knights dies this moon, though, we'll know that it was merely an accident, and had nothing to do with the compact."
"We're going to lose them one every month?"
"Moon," she corrected. 28 days. "Most probably, yes. The younger gods tend to be methodical about such things. Don't concern yourself about me, Sparhawk. I'll be all right in a little while."
It was some 60 leagues from the Count's castle to the city of Dara, and on the morning of the 4th day of their journey they crested a hill and looked down upon the red tile roofs and the hundreds of chimneys sending pale blue columns of smoke straight up into the windless air. A black-armored Pandion knight awaited them on the hilltop.
"Sir Sparhawk," the knight said, raising his visor.
"Sir Ulvan," Sparhawk replied, recognizing the knight's scarred face.
"I have a message for you from Preceptor Vanion. He instructs you to proceed directly to Simera with all possible speed."
"Simera? Why the change in plans?"
"King Dragos is there, and he's invited Worgen of Thalesia and Obler of Deira to join him. He wants to investigate the illness of Queen Alana, and the justification for the appointment of the bastard Lycaeus as Prince Regent. Vanion believes that Annius will level his charges against our order at that council, in order to deflect an inquiry that might be embarrassing."
Sparhawk swore.
"Beirut's a good way ahead of us by now," he said. "Have all the kings gathered in Simera yet?"
Ulvan shook his head.
"King Obler is too old to travel very fast, and it's likely to take a week to sober King Worgen up before he can make the voyage from Emsat."
"Let's not gamble on that," Sparhawk said. "We'll cut across country to Deimos, and then ride directly to Simera. Is Vanion still at Kyrolos?"
"No. He came through Deimos on his way to Simera. The Patriarch Dolmant was with him."
"Dolmant?" Colton said. "That's a surprise. Who's running the church?"
"Sir Colton," Count Radin said stiffly, "the guidance of the church is in the hands of the Archprelate."
"Sorry, my lord," Colton apologized. "I know how much Arshans revere the church, but let's be honest. Archprelate Clavonus is 85 years old and he sleeps a great deal. Dolmant doesn't make an issue of it, but most of the decisions that come out of Kyrolos are his."
"Let's ride," Sparhawk said. It took them 4 days of hard traveling to reach Deimos, for Sir Ulvan left them to return to the Pandion Mother House, and it was 3 more days before they arrived at the gates of the Chapter House in Simera.
"Do you know where we can find Lord Vanion?"
Sparhawk asked the novice who came out into the courtyard to take their horses.
"He's in his study in the South Tower, my lord, with the Patriarch Dolmant."
Sparhawk nodded and led the way inside and up the narrow stairs.
"Thank God you arrived in time," Vanion greeted them.
"Did Beirut deliver the Count's ring yet?" Sparhawk asked him. Vanion nodded.
2 days ago. I had men inside the cathedral watching."
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.